Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Buddhist Centre podcast with me, Chandra Dasa. I'm on my own this week, sadly. I don't have my team, my Dharma Chakra crew, with me, but it's still a delight to be here because I'm very excited for this particular episode. It's one that I've been hoping to do for ages, and somehow it's all just come together in the way that things sometimes do, very fortuitously. And we're going to be talking today about, I suppose, art in the broadest way, but particularly animation, puppetry, illustration. You'll have seen some stuff that we've featured over the years on the platform in this vein, and I'm very happy to say we've got some great guests today who are practicing artists and have contributed amazing content, helping bring to life Buddhist themes, the life of the Buddha itself, which is quite an old tradition in a way. We'll touch on that, no doubt, today. So I'm going to welcome each of my guests, and then we'll dive right into the conversation, starting with the only person who's been here before. The other two are newbies. So welcome back, Mandarava, to the podcast.
Hi, Chandra Dasa, and hello, Aryajit and Prasannavira. Lovely to be here. I'm based in Hastings. I'm in my living room at the moment. I've been working today on preparing for a workshop, so I'm surrounded by puppets. It's quite a small space. It's a bit mad in here at the moment, but yeah, preparing for a story I'm going to be doing over the weekend.
And what's the story about over the weekend?
So it's called The Handless Maiden, which is a fairy story. Quite a powerful fairy story.
And just so people who don't know, what does your name mean, Mandarava?
So my name is a flower. It's a big cosmic flower, size of a cartwheel, I think. And it floats down from the heavens when the Buddha's giving a good talk. So it's like a mythic offering. That was why it was given to me. Also, Mandarava was a historical figure as well. She was a practitioner in her own right, associated with Padmasambhava, who's a great magician figure. So yeah, I feel very blessed to be given a name like that. It's got multiple meanings. And it got a whole story in itself, in a way, to get involved with.
Well, it's nice to have a magic introduction. I'd be slightly disappointed if a giant cartwheel-like flower doesn't float down at some point during this conversation.
Yeah, I'm going to hurl a few cartwheels.
We hit the heights on this podcast. You never know, folks. And welcome for the first time to the podcast, which I can't quite believe. Welcome to you, Aryajit.
Hello, Chandradasa. Hello, Mandarava. Hello, Prasannavira. Lovely to be here. My name's Aryajit. I live in Hartford in England, and I'm doing very well. And my name, Aryajit, means he who is victorious through noble means.
No pressure at all with your name. He who is victorious through noble means. My experience of you, you are quite victorious, certainly in your work anyway, which we'll come to. And also for the first time on the podcast is our friend Prasannavira. Hi, Prasannavira. Where are you dialing in from today?
I'm in Cambridge, England, and actually in the Cambridge Buddhist Centre. Just finished my day's work in the office where I work. I'm okay. Looking forward to the weekend, though, I must say. My name, Prasannavira. So Prasanna means clear, bright, or pure. Vira, hero, warrior, or chief. So sometimes it gets shortened to clear, bright, pure hero.
It makes quite a difference, doesn't it, having a conversation with like cosmic flower, victorious, noble one, and pure, bright, and clear. Wow. My name, Chandradasa, means sort of follower of the moon. So there you go. Amongst all of us, we've got quite a range of stuff, a lot of which involves light, actually. So it'll be interesting to see if that comes in. But hey, Mandarava, maybe you can get us going on the conversation. You've been on the podcast before because you and your partner Naga City have led for us some home retreats, some home practice on the Buddhist Centre Live. And it's been a bit out of the ordinary for us. And we've really loved it as a team because most of our events are pretty straightforward Buddhist events with meditation and some Dharma teaching, some discussion. And that's fantastic. And you and Naga City bring this other element in where you're basically making puppets and animation and this physical animation and shadow animation, and you're telling stories and it involves music. Totally beautiful. Maybe we'll come into that more later, but how did you get started in that way of approaching Dharma practice and bringing so fully these art forms in to tell mythic stories about the Buddha and about others?
I suppose maybe I'll say a bit about how I got involved with puppetry first. I was quite established as a maker and an artist in a way. I went to art college and yeah, I was very drawn to the visual arts, but I also quite interested in the performing arts. But I was quite a shy person. So for me, making puppets felt like a really good way of bringing different things together. So it was a way I could communicate my creativity. And then when I got to a point of trying to resolve that tension between wanting to perform and being more of a maker, my brother got very ill. So unfortunately and sadly, he died quite young. He was ill as a child, but it came back when he was a young adult. And I was involved along with my parents and other brother in the care for him. Anyway, after he died, I got involved in quite a project really to sort of come to terms with all that. But also, I wanted to make a little figure of him. I think I was trying to make sense of where's he gone or what's happened or how could I carry on a relationship with him in some way. So I made this little mythic version of him and then of the whole of our family. It grew into quite an installation. And I showed this installation on a Buddhist convention. And as part of it, there was a tower with a five Buddha mandala in the middle of the tower. And I suppose that was where the Dharma started to come in to real life experience and then also wanting to tell a personal story in that case. And then from that led into other projects over the years of how do I communicate either what feels really important and significant about life, living a life, things that happen? Then how do I communicate, about the Dharma? How do I get that across in a way that for someone who's not so cognitive, I'm quite a feeling person and also like to use images and different ways to communicate. That's very potted, but that's how it unfolded a bit.
And the making, I know from previous conversations, the making is quite important, isn't it? You're sort of engaging with myth with your body, you're making stuff with your hands, and you're literally bringing them to life, as it were.
I suppose maybe you're also transporting yourself into something and you're trying to make sense of something by making it. I think that's what happens to me is I get into things become clearer, or there's understanding comes, or there's a care and love that goes on as well. There's something about when you're creating something, I always feel I have to really love it. There's a feeling of love at some point in that process, I think, particularly with the puppets, I suppose, because they are like little beings that you're almost bringing to life. So it is like nurturing something into life.
They're very beautiful puppets as well. We'll include some pictures on the show notes for this so people can go and look at the work, and it's not just listening to the stories of it. Arijit, I suppose just picking up that theme of making things and there being something beautiful and essential about it. I'm really delighted to have you on the podcast because we talk fairly regularly. And it only occurred to me recently that we never actually had you on as a guest. You've been working with us at Dharmachakra for a few years now. We made a really great animated film about fear and how to work with it as Buddhists during the COVID pandemic, right at the start of lockdown. I know a lot of people were really grateful to you for doing that. It was actually helpful as well as beautiful. And the Discover Buddhism section of the new Buddhist Center Online is basically full of your illustrations and your animations. People can go and check that out. How did this approach to communicating the Dharma become such a central passion project for you?
Well, from an early age, I've always liked drawing and I've always liked movies as well. I always like movies with a touch of magic about them. So it's an interest that goes back to when I was a child. And obviously, drawings and movies kind of go together quite well. When I was a child growing up, you didn't have all this technology to make it really easy to do things like animation at home. So it wasn't until I got to university, I was doing a degree in media production where you could do all sorts of different things, filmmaking, radio. Well, I was really drawn to animation, I think, because I could just do it on my own and control everything to kind of create my own world. I could delve into the more subjective pole of experience, stories and myths and legend that are, philosophically speaking, they're more subjective. Eventually, I got into Buddhism. So this project I'm doing of trying to make do Buddhist illustrations, Buddhist animations, brings together all my interests and skills. And when you can do that, I think when you've got a project that brings all those things together, brings your skills together, your interests, and hopefully something meaningful as well, then it's just a real passion project. It's something that you think, oh, yeah, this is exactly what I want to do.
I think the thing with your work that I'm always struck by is it is very contemporary. Like it's a real mashup or smash up of images and styles and quite bold with big music, techno, and lots of neon and collage cutout magazine style issues. Also, with quite a beautiful sensibility around how to draw a mythic figure like the Buddha with a reverence. They're all in there together and it works. I suppose I was really struck by what a feel you have for how to navigate all those different levels of image making and marrying those images together in something that is bigger than the sum of all its parts.
Well, I could say something about that actually, because particularly the element of doing Buddhism in a modern style, one of the major influences on me was Star Wars. And I think what Star Wars does is presents kind of ancient myths and legends in a modern way, which kind of speaks to us. And I loved that as a child. And when I got older and I came across Tree Ratner, I found that Tree Ratner was kind of trying to do something similar. It's trying to reach into these ancient Buddhist teachings and myths and legend and make them relevant for us today. That was really exciting to me because it made me think, well, that can be the adventure of my life. I can practice Buddhism and it can be, not just like a film you watch or something or a nice story, but actually something you do with your life. It can actually be the adventure of your life. And this was something I could actually do. I think that's what Buddhism has always done through the ages, is try and communicate, be faithful to the Buddha's principles, these ancient principles, but communicate them in a modern way, which is relevant to us. And so I love trying to do with my illustrations and animations is try and present them in a way which is fresh and new, not go with the cliche vision of like using music, which will really surprise people. I really like trying to do that, almost shock people sometimes. I just really want to surprise people and make them think this is really relevant to your life. This is really relevant to what's going on now.
That's great. And Prasannaveera, you're here from the Windhorse Trust, which we'll hear more about in a little minute, but you're not here as an illustrator. You're not here as an artist. Is that right?
That is correct. So I'm not a visual artist. I am a martial artist, but that's a whole other podcast, I think. So I've got two daughters who are now teenagers, but when they were young, they would often ask myself or my wife, Sarah, to draw for them. And I always dreaded that prospect because it felt like a trap. I'm not particularly gifted at drawing. Both my daughters are much better than me. One of them's very, very good indeed, actually. So they would have in mind the perfect elephant that they wanted me to draw. And they would ask me to draw an elephant. And I knew right from the very beginning, this is not going to be what they want. And it never was. And I got so much flak from them. Maybe that's put me off drawing.
Maybe you could send us a picture of an elephant. We can use it as the cover for the podcast. That'd be great.
I want an elephant.
Maybe I'll get them to do an elephant, shall I? I'll get
And
one from
you.
each of us.
One from each, yeah,
One
the
from
three
each of you.
elephants. That'd be great. I was particularly interested to have you in this conversation from a different angle. You recently decided at the Windhorse Trust to give major grant to Aryajit to underwrite, I guess, his new Legend of the Buddha animation project. So maybe you could introduce the trust and its work a little bit, just as context. And then what was it about Aryajit's work and his proposal around the Legend of the Buddha that really resonated for you and the team at Windhorse?
The Windhorse Trust, we're based in Cambridge. Essentially, our mission is to provide funds for projects within Tree Ratna to help to spread the teachings of the Buddha. So we give away in the region of £100,000 a year to different projects, as well as having a range of loans which we use to help support different projects around the world. Our main source of income is rental income from property. So we grew out of a business called Windhorse Trading, which was very successful in the 1990s and enabled the Windhorse Trust to buy several large properties in Cambridge, which we now rent out both as residential Buddhist communities, but also other properties of HMOs, houses of multiple occupancy. We're effectively a landlord, but part of our mission is to provide good quality accommodation for people to meet that basic need. And in the process, we generate surplus to give away to different projects around Tree Ratna. And I go back quite a way with Aryajit, actually. We were both around the London Buddhist Centre in the 1990s. I was surprised to hear from Aryajit with this request, although I did know that he was an animator and visual artist, so I wasn't surprised in that sense. But it was very good to hear from him again. I think personally, I was just struck that animation seems to be such a novel way of communicating the teachings of the Buddha. And the digital platforms that we have which are so much part of our lives now, seem to be a very effective way to reach many, many people. So as part of our mission to support projects within Sri Ratna in order to communicate the teachings of the Buddha, it seemed a very good project to support, both in terms of the quality, but also the reach. Now, we're sort of rather ad hoc in terms of our decisions as to what we support. We don't have a formal process that we go through. We have a body of trustees, and the trustees are plugged into different networks within the Sri Ratna Buddhist community. As such, we're able to, in an informal way, use that network to help us to establish where might be the best directions that we can use our money. So we had some dialogue with some of the institutions that are more involved with the teaching of the Buddha within Sri Ratna. And the view seemed to be that Arijit's work was very good. Unfortunately, there isn't very much money around, so they were unable to support Arijit, but we were. It was actually quite a modest grant that we gave him, really. But yeah, very, very happy to support Arijit, and we'd be happy to consider supporting other projects within Sri Ratna. Quite a big chunk of our money goes to an organisation called the Future Dharma Fund, and they have a more formal process of deciding where best to channel the money. So we rely on the Future Dharma Fund to a large degree to do that. So very often if projects go to the Future Dharma Fund and they say, well, actually, it's not quite within our remit, then they may come to us and ask us for money. We will then go through a process and decide how best to proceed.
Yeah, I mean, the Windrush Trust has been a really big supporter of Dharma Chakra, which is the body I work for, and we've been making digital Buddhist media for a long time. It's been amazing, actually, how forward-thinking the Trust has been supporting early efforts to digitize Dharma lectures when nobody even knew what that was. And then we were proposing websites to give them away for free online, and some people thought that was the craziest idea you could possibly have. And actually, people at Windrush have always been super generous and got it quite early. So it really cheered me up when I heard that you were giving a grant, however modest, to Arijit to finish his work.
I'll just say, Chandradasa, one of the areas that we'll try to focus on is helping startup projects. So within the Sri Ratna Buddhist community, there are many people who are requiring to be supported financially in order to do their ongoing work. We tend not to focus on supporting those people. We tend to focus more on startup projects or projects that already exist but want to scale up. We maybe focus more on capital projects, often buildings, actually. So a retreat center, purchase of a new retreat center, for example, or a bigger urban Buddhist center for a particular project. I think this animation project was something that we wouldn't necessarily have done in the past. It wasn't something that came our way. But we're very happy to support that and also obviously support your project as well, Chandradasa, where we can.
Yeah, that's great. So, hey, we've got these projects going. I'm just looking at our screen. Of course, if you're listening to this, you won't see our faces, but let's just say we're all of a certain age at this point. Let's just say Gen Xers. Should we say we're all mostly part of Gen X? So we're no longer quite young people anymore. We're not old, but we're not young. And what I was thinking about in terms of age was we grew up in the UK in a world where older styles of stop motion puppet animation, illustrative animation, were all still very much staples of children's television. I grew up watching that stuff. I'm thinking specifically here of the works of Oliver Postgate and Peter Fermin, Bagpuss, Noggin the Nog, Ivor the Engine. I'm going to restrain myself from just reminiscing nostalgically. We'll put notes in the show notes if you have no idea what those things are. Go and watch them on YouTube. They're really beautiful. We'll share some links for you. But I was interested, Arijit and Mandarva, what were your particular influences when you were growing up around animation and puppetry, if at all, or in art generally?
A bit of Bagpuss, the whole magic of the shop and that big old cat in the window and then all these little mice on a music organ machine. And the Wombles, actually, although not necessarily the look of the Wombles, but the whole message of the Wombles, I suppose it was early recycling, wasn't it? But it was making things out of nothing. I loved making something out of rubbish.
Just for people who don't know, The Wombles by Elizabeth Beresford, which is a pretty popular series of children's books from the UK originally, now worldwide, I think. They were made into a BBC TV show involving puppets. And what was their tagline? It was things that the everyday folks leave behind. That's what they made.
I think as well, I was brought up more with fairy tales. I remember being given a book of Swedish fairy tales, and the illustrations in that book really stayed with me. The illustrator John Bauer, Princess Cotton Grass, was the story I was most captivated by. So different influences, and I guess I was taken to the theatre quite a bit. My father was a theatre designer, so that impacted me as well. Magic of theatre. He took me to different things.
Yeah, well, I too loved Oliver Postgate. Things were still showing when I was at young. In fact, my email is profyaffle@hotmail.com. So Professor Yaffle was a woodpecker who lived with Bagpuss. He was a very serious kind of professor, but he was a little woodpecker.
Can you do a Professor Yaffle
I
impersonation? Can
can,
we hear
yeah,
it?
okay.
Come
You're not being serious. See, I used to love all that. Something about the whimsy of those. And if you look back at them now, they're so simple compared to what you watch now. They're so high production values today. And they seem a bit homogenized, the computer animation. But Oliver Postgate was just like a guy in his shed making these little puppets. And something so charming about that, something really delightful about the world he created. So, yeah, I love all that. Also mentioned Star Wars. I used to just love Star Wars. I used to read up on how they made them, the special effects and all that. All the models and things they made, I used to love all that stuff. So that was the big influence.
I mean, in the Buddhist tradition itself, almost as long as we have records, people have been making beautiful illuminated illustrations of episodes from the Buddha's life. People might have seen some of these on book covers from our community. I think there was a phase where there were a lot of book covers. It's amazing actually to go to the museums and see them in person on bark. Quite often it's like pigment on bark. In more modern times, there's been an epic Life of the Buddha Japanese manga series by Osamu Tezuka, which was from the 70s and 80s. And of course, manga has its roots back in some of the woodblock print traditions in Japan, people like Hokusai. Has any of that traditional artwork from cultures that were Buddhist, older Buddhist cultures than the one we're in, has any of that been important to you in your own Dharma practice or work?
Well, I recently did Legend of the Buddha. I always search online for references to, images that I can use as reference points. So, for instance, Mara's army has got elements from Chinese images of Mara's soldiers, stuff from Indian mythology as well. I always look for as ancient as possible, really. So, a lot of the old stone friezes and things, I try and take as much stuff from early sources as I can. I also put in the Lincoln Imp, who's a mythological figure from where I grew up in Lincoln. There's this gargoyle called the Lincoln Imp, and I put him in there as well. So I like to mix it up.
And Prasenabhira, has any of the traditional Buddhist art been inspirational to you in your own Dharma practice?
Well, I was thinking as Irajit and Mandarava were speaking, having a family, bringing a family up within a Buddhist context, how important Buddhist imagery and particularly storybooks have been to them. The culture within our family. And while we have all been very moved by Studio Ghibli, as one of them in particular, Princess Kaguya by Studio Ghibli is a very, very beautiful story, really gently and delicately told. That's one of the favourite stories and very important stories for both of my daughters as they grew up. For both of my daughters, it's completely up to them whether they decide to regard themselves as Buddhists or not, but our hope has been that we've been able to introduce them to and help them to live within a set of positive values that the Buddhist teachings communicate. To some extent, I think we've done that or doing that. They're both lovely, lovely people, and I think that they've been influenced in that way. And certainly, art has been a very important part of that. My eldest daughter, actually, her intention is to be an artist. She's studying art at the moment. Well, this is a few years ago now, but her ambition was to be an artist creating images for the London Buddhist Centre. That was her ideal job, a dream
Wow.
job. She creates a lot of Buddhist imagery. Some of it, I must admit, quite dark, but at the same time, she's exploring something through art, through imagery, and that's helping her. She's had some health issues and it's helping her to navigate her way through quite a dark period in her life. I must admit, personally, I'm not particularly kind of visually tuned in. My path, if you like, has been a bit more kinesthetic rather than visual. But nonetheless, one can't help but be affected by imagery and the visual input, visual world that we live in.
No, thanks for that, Sandra. It's lovely to hear that story about your daughter, actually. It's very moving. It's really nice to hear about the Princess Kaguya as well, because there's an amazing piece of music at the end of that film where the gods and goddesses all come down from the heavens with the Bodhisattva princess. That's really beautiful.
Yeah, I find that really interesting area. Listening to you, Prasanavira, talking about your daughter, both in you saying some of it's quite dark, and yet she's obviously also drawn to the Buddhist stories or the Buddhist imagery, and how to bring the struggles we might have in ourselves, or even historically, some of us have traumas, or just the struggle with whether being a Buddhist means being a kind of perfectly developed, loving, all-giving being, and actually you can't live up to that. The stories that I get interested in, or that I've been looking at, have been fairy stories, partly because they bring in a bit of those struggles a bit more, and they, to me sometimes anyway, feel quite relatable too, because they've got a bit more of an emotional content. But it's something about bringing our own personal paths in relationship to the ideals and to some of the stories that can feel a bit distant. It's just an interesting area of how to make it both accessible and personable in the way I'm trying to communicate anyway through some of the story work I'm doing. And I've just started to explore some of the stories of some of the historical female characters, Mandarava, Bachik Labtrong, and Nagsa Obum, who's a Tibetan female practitioner. And just the challenge of making those stories, both being true to the history, but also making them accessible to modern day women, is a really interesting tension, I think.
Yeah, I was just thinking that for both my daughters, in the way they've grown up within a Buddhist context, as a result, that's been, to some extent, the water that they've been swimming in. So they've brought their struggles to that context, rather than, for most of us, we've come across Buddhism later in life and perhaps had projections onto it as being about being kind and being emotionally positive and being drawn towards the light, etc. But I think in a way, they're approaching it from a different point of view. They're almost swimming up from the depth towards the light, rather than approaching the light from the outside in, as it were. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense.
As a result, that is the medium that they've been given in order to explore their experience. And they're both daughters, actually. They both use art a lot. My elder one kind of identifies more strongly with that process, but they both use visual imagery and creation of visual imagery to explore their experience, which is wonderful to see, because so many young people sadly grow out of, lose touch with a sense of the magic or the process of creativity that they have when they're younger children. I'm very pleased to say that neither of mine have lost touch with that.
That's great to hear.
It's interesting hearing about the effect of growing up in a world where Buddhist art is there on your daughter's Prasanavira. In fact, that one of your daughter's ambition, at least in the past, has been articulated as, I want to make images for the London Buddhist Centre. That's kind of amazing. I suppose people listening might know there are traditional forms or representative Buddhist painting and sculpture, often referred to as tanka and rupa making. We have quite a few well-known people in our order who work in those forms. I'm thinking about people like Aloka and Chintamani. And we also have successful contemporary artists who are in our order and working as artists, Alison Harper, Hugh Mendes, who would do a feature on the Buddhist Centre Online. And their work also lives in relationship to Buddhist practice and the various traditions of Buddhist art. I guess I was wondering, for Arijit and Mandarva, have you been aware of your style being particularly influenced by those traditional forms of people who paint Buddha and Bodhisattva figures or mandalas in those particularly classically trained styles? Or is it more just, again, like you're swimming in that world and somehow it impacts? Where do you fall in that sort of range? Because obviously you're doing something that's a bit different. You're not doing still images in quite the same way.
Probably somewhere in the middle. I think I respond to traditional tankas and rupas. You know, I have in the past made my own kind of interpretations of those different Buddhist figures at different times. There's a simplicity in how I respond to it. So it's stripped down, I think. Again, it's a wish to both connect with my own practice and pour that into something I'm making whilst wanting to reach other people as well in some way and finding the form that takes. Yeah, I think I'm probably just somewhere in the middle. I am quite literal in some ways with what I do, in that it's not too abstracted or too loose as an interpretation, but at the same time, I think there is a moving away from absolute rules and traditions, because there are really lots of restrictions around how you do tankers traditionally, aren't there? So I'm not quite following that. Formal. I wouldn't follow that.
When you first encountered those kinds of images, because they're quite different even to formal Western religious art, right? They don't look like the sort of paintings you'll see of Christian scenes from previous centuries. When you first came across explicitly Buddhist imagery as you were starting to explore Buddhism, did you notice the difference, or was it just more like this is just a natural part of the world? And
I did respond to them. So I noticed the difference more now, but I quite liked Indian miniatures and I was quite drawn to Eastern imagery, actually. I now am slightly more careful. If I'm doing a ritual or something, I really want to include other associations and connections, like Green Tara, for instance. If I'm doing something at Rivendell, I'll bring in very much the local landscape of that retreat centre as a way to help people find their way into a green female figure. Just trying to find ways in that make it more accessible.
Yeah, when I draw the Buddha, there's kind of an image of the Buddha that people have, isn't there? The long ears and the curly hair and the bump on his head and so on. I felt that when I was doing my legend of the Buddha, I had to follow some of those rules, if you like, but I wanted to add my own ideas. I often ask for feedback on things. Chandradas, you said a few times, could you make the Buddha look a bit friendlier? Because I always make him look quite stern. I suppose partly I just want to get across the idea that the Buddha was a very determined and powerful presence, as well as being incredibly kind and compassionate. So it's fun being able to decide on those things, you know, have that control and put my version of Buddha over. You've got to pay respect to the past and to the tradition, and you've got to be recognizably the Buddha, but it's fun being able to add my own kind of things I like about the idea of the Buddha. The other day I was drawing an image of the Buddha. After his enlightenment, he talks to his old friends, the five ascetics. And I wanted him to be really excited about what he was saying, really enthusiastic, and them to be really kind of amazed by what he was saying. I've never seen a picture of the Buddha like that before. So it's really exciting to be doing that, because it's kind of adding to the tradition in a way, isn't it? I mean, that maybe sounds a bit over the top, but we are, aren't we? We're adding to the tradition. And that's what we need to do. You know, we need to find our own connections with Buddhism and then present that to keep the tradition alive. We can't stay stuck in the past and keep on producing the same old things. So that's the work we're doing. And that's what makes it so exciting. Yeah.
It's really interesting to hear about that idea of lineage almost. You consciously taking part in the lineage, an artistic lineage with Buddhism.
Well, it just made me think of the woodpecker as you were talking. At the beginning, you mentioned how he was quite stern and this sort of stern and kindly magical figure. I just thought, oh, yeah, the Buddha is the woodpecker and professor, whatever he's called.
I feel not very well qualified to comment on this, but one thought I have is about the realm of the imagination, that I'd strongly feel that the imagination needs to be alive. It is living, in fact. Traditional images can stimulate and be very much part of the life of the imagination. If there's no sense of that current or that flow, that river of the imagination bringing forth new forms or new images, then one has to wonder how living it is, really. I think it's very, very important that as a Buddhist order and as individual practicing Buddhists, we do all we can to keep that alive. There's an individual responsibility there for all of us to keep in contact with those depths or those heights or whatever it is, that inspiration, but also as a community to do what we can to keep that alive. And that was one of the reasons why I was very happy for us to support Arijit, because although money is a bit dull in a sense, we need money to do what we want to do. That's the way the world works. We need money to support us in order to set up the conditions for us all to keep that flame of inspiration and imagination and that river, I'm mixing my metaphors wildly here, that river alive and flowing. Of course, we need new forms. Of course, we need new images. Of course, we need to mine stories from Western and other traditions in order to keep that river as flames, whatever image you want to use, alive. But if we just stop and just rely on traditional images, it seems a bit of a shame, really, that we're allowing something to not live in the way that it has to live. After all, in a way, the imagination is primary, really, in terms of our practice.
My kids aren't as immersed in the Buddhist world as much as Prasanna Veera's, but they've been on retreats. They've grown up with it as well. I remember we were at Astana on a festival or retreat. My kids took in part in a theatre, a play, you know, they just arranged it over a couple of days. And it was very ramshackle kind of thing, but it was a lot of fun. It was the life of Padmasambhava, I think, or Padmasambhava introducing Buddhism to Tibet. And it was great fun. They had a good time doing that. And I'm really pleased they're growing up knowing who Padmasambhava is, what a Vajra is, and the stories of the Buddha. I'd love us to do more of that as a community. My idea is to have a retreat at Alfoxden, which is one of our retreat centres, where we all get together, have a play to organise. And so, you know, some of us act or whatever, and some of us do whatever we can, with writers or whatever, direct it. And then at the end of the retreat, we've kind of studied the material, whatever stories. My idea is the scenes from the Pali Canon or stories from the Pali Canon. You know, a lot of humour, a lot of fun, because some of the stories are very fun and some of them are quite crazy. And so we get the idea of having this play and then we go around and perform it at different centres because it's telling stories and it is just a way that everyone can enjoy, kind of children can enjoy it and understand it. There's something magic about stories, isn't there? And the process of doing that as well, you learn about the material, you go deeper in. If anyone's interested in that, get in touch with Jayaraja Alfoxden because he's really keen on that idea as well. Yeah, I think we need as much as that as we can. Like Prasanna Veera is saying, that imaginative life, without that, it can't just be all dry concepts, can it? The imagination is what keeps it alive.
When I did the exhibition of the installation around my brother, I set up these puppets around this tower and someone brought their daughter along to have a look at it. She was about 8, I think. She just had her first bereavement. And when she came in to see these puppets and her mum explained a bit about what the puppets were and that my brother had died, she just went towards the puppets and she wanted to put a little blanket on my brother puppet. And then she wanted to go and feed the puppet of my mum. And it was just so powerful, the impact of her making sense of death, you know, as having a conversation with these figures and really tender relationship and a way for her to start to make sense of what it was to lose someone or to have a death. Anyway, it's something about the power of imagery and again of story to communicate things to people and how important that is, how powerful it is. And it's those images that stay with people, I think, more often. People who've come on some of the retreats I've done with stories, they really remember the imagery and then what's been tried to be communicated through that.
I keep getting sparked off in Bedknobs and Broomsticks, the Disney film. There's a phrase that they talk about when a child reaches the age of not believing. And it always seems so sad that that happens. And I hope that none of us reach that age, actually. But that wasn't what I was going to say. When I first came along to the London Buddhist Centre in 1990, there were a group of order members who were really inspired by Padmasambhava. And each year we'd have a Padmasambhava festival. Chintamani, the artist, was very much involved with this. And they would dramatise stories from the life and liberation of Padmasambhava, of his life story. And it was so strong, really strong. It was something that really was a very influential part in me wanting to get more involved and deepen my Buddhist practice. And just picking up on that dramatization, that theater, and the magic that it brought forth was so important. I really missed those days, actually. There was a whole sort of group of people who were so inspired of masks, costumes, dramatization, all in the context of ritual. Very, very powerful stuff. Just the other day, I was wishing we could, or maybe I can, start
maybe
to bring it back, but wishing that as a community, we had more of that.
A few different things here, Prasanna, some of which hopefully might cheer you up a little bit. The first thing was actually, because you're in Cambridge and you're in this beautiful Georgian Theatre, one of the last Georgian theatres in England, which is the Cambridge Buddhist Centre. I lived in Cambridge back when that first came into our hands as a community. And in the first couple of years, we did do these big multimedia dramatized retellings of pretty cosmic Buddhist texts like the Sutra of Golden Light and the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. I actually played Vimalakirti. I remember sitting on the stage with all the finery on and stuff. And I recognized that thing of it making me want to go more deeply into Buddhism was because it was like a whole body experience in a way. And like it involved all of these different bits. But the thing I was thinking about was we were in Mexico City for the Pan American sort of convention last year. And at the Mexico City Buddhist Center, which is a massive space, they did this amazing multimedia performance based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And it blended traditional imagery from that central text, which is almost like a dream, really, with aspects of local indigenous Mexican culture. It was really amazing. It was a really amazing piece. There's one little clip of it, I think, that we posted on our Instagram feed. So I'll try and find that and link to it. I suppose the point of that for me was it arose naturally out of people's interest in the community, the way you were saying, Prasannavira, that used to happen in London at the London Buddhist Centre. But you also had some really skilled artists taking part in it. There was an amazing middle section of shadow puppetry that was part of it. And it seemed like the perfect form for communicating this very elusive thing about the states of consciousness that might pertain after death. Just coming back to this conversation, and both you, Mandarva, and Aryajit, in some of the work you've done with us, that particular style, the shadow puppet and the silhouette animation, you were saying earlier, Mandarva, just stripping forms back to something really simple. It's really super effective. And I can still remember some of your images just as I'm talking about them. What is it about the style that draws you? Is it just the simplicity of it? Is it to do with the dreamlike nature?
Yeah, there is something about the simplicity of it. I quite like folk art, and I suppose, again, early storytelling and even image making of a community would be quite simple in its dolls or its little wood carvings or cutouts. So I suppose it's partly that. I like that kind of style. And then accidentally, I did it with a projector, being not very technically aware. I did it with an old-fashioned projector with bits of cut-out cardboard originally and projected it on a wall, the Inyana story, and then took photos of it. And then I embellished the photos. So it kind of evolved into this, oh, that works quite well. Oh, I'll bring in a bit of colour or how I evolved that. So it was slightly accidental, but I fell on a style that seemed to work as a way of telling that story. And with Inyana, it's such an ancient myth as well that the images are very simple. The original imagery of that goddess figure is depicted very simply anyway. So I think it kind of came from that and then suddenly it flowed out. I didn't quite get to animate it, but as a illustrative technique, it worked well. Such a long process, animation. I'd really like to do it, but I don't think my back will hold out for the amount of time you have to sit working on those things. But yeah, I love the whole idea of animation, actually.
That's just reminded me actually of an influence of mine when I did those silhouette animations of the Buddha, which I think you'd like. I don't know if you've heard of it. She's called Lottie Rainer,
Oh,
if you've
yeah,
met.
no, I do. Yeah, I love
Yeah,
her work. Yeah.
I really like her work, those silhouettes, and she tells those fairy tales, isn't she? Really, really
Yeah.
wonderful. Yeah. My friend Dan, he sent me a video from Buddha Day at Southampton, where he and his friends and some order members got together and did a Life of the Buddha puppet show. There was one order member narrating, there was another order member playing the guitar, and these two mitras called Dan and Dylan were operating the puppets and telling the story of the Buddha. And they obviously spent a lot of time on it and had a lot of fun doing it. Watching the video, it just looks great. You know, so it struck me that's exactly what festival day should be. There's people having fun and the children in the audience, and it just looked great. I just encourage everyone, if you want to do something like that, if you've got an idea, just do it. You know, so it makes such a difference, I think.
Yeah, that's great. It really strikes me listening to this conversation, listening to the things that we've talked about around storytelling as part of a Buddhist community, that it's really deeply vocational work, what you're involved with, not just the vocation, I suppose, of a spiritual life of some kind, but particularly this application of art and all the hours and all the training and all the experiment and all the failure and all the success. I wondered, I don't know if you are happy and comfortable seeing yourselves as artists. I don't know if that's what your passport says, as artist. But how do you view the life of a Buddhist artist now after doing it for decades, right? You're not new to this. Does it still feel like an exciting horizon? You're still learning, you're still doing new things.
Yes, it is still alive, and I do still feel very engaged with how to communicate the Dharma through some form of image making or storytelling. And currently, I'm quite interested in bringing to life visualization practice of some sort. It's a particular practice that is quite mythic and fairy tale like in its nature, where a figure is offered into a big cauldron that's supported by three skulls, and then she's turned into nectar, and then the nectar is given out to all the different beings. Anyone's welcome, any type of being from any realm is welcome to receive this nectar, and they may be quite destructive and in pain, or they may just be really in need. But that's where my energy's going at the moment. Talking about, the early days of the Padmasambhava storytelling that Prasannavira was talking about, but also in Tibetan culture, it's so much part of their culture, as in Mexican culture, where those figures and that making and that storytelling, the ritual is all very much part of their life and expression. It makes sense, I think, why that's coming through for me at the moment as a natural progression. The deeper I go into my practice as well, I just want it to be visible in some way, bring it to life.
In terms of art and the Dharma, there are two things which are kind of infinite. They're endless. And so I feel like I'm just getting started. I've got so many videos I want to make. I'll probably never finish them all. I'll need a few more lifetimes to get to do all the work. Like Mandava was saying, animation takes so long that I need so much time. Prasannavira was saying you can't draw elephants. And there are a lot of people feel that they can't draw. But Prasannavira is definitely an artist in the sense that he has an imaginative life. I tend to think we all need to become artists to practice the Dharma. We all need to ignite our creative minds. I'd also like to say, just on the record, thank you very much to Prasannavira and the Windhorse Trust for giving me that grant because it's made such a difference to me. Obviously, I've thanked him by email, but I want to say thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm really very, very pleased that makes some difference. From a personal point of view, it's some weird fluke that I've ended up with my life revolving around spreadsheets and money and so on. It's not really my thing, although it has become my thing by default. I'm very drawn to what I believe in. I guess it's an article of belief in the sense that I believe in the life of the imagination. I think if the life of the imagination isn't a life of imagination, then in a sense, there's a certain aspect of us which is dead. If we're not living from that point, I'm not talking about inspiration in the sense of lifted up or whatever, but it's just a sense of some kind of magic in our life. Some sense of meaning, of symbolism. I've got a strong connection with my meditation practice and visualization practice. As I was saying earlier, it's not necessarily my connection with visualization practice is not necessarily visual. There is a sense of kinesthesia to it. But nonetheless, although imagination contains the word image, I think actually it's much deeper and much broader than that. There's a sense of life there. And almost by definition, if that life isn't there, then something is not living. And for a spiritual life to be alive, the imagination needs to be alive. And that will take all sorts of forms according to whatever form it's taking. I mean, that sounds like a tautology, but actually, I think that is the case, that something needs to have a life of its own in a sense. So all power to Mandava and Arijit and others who are giving expression to that life of imagination and fueling that life of imagination for themselves and for others. And yeah, I'm very happy that the trust has been able to help in that way. The life of imagination is central to my own spiritual life. That is how it is. I'd have to be another person for it to be another way. I find myself surprisingly engaged with this podcast because I was expecting just to be a sort of bit of a money man, but actually, I think it's getting to the heart of the matter. So thank you, Chandradasa, for inviting me.
Oh, thank you, Prasanna. You're definitely not just a money man. In a way, that's the perfect sum up of the podcast, of the conversation we've had. I wish it could go on much longer, just celebrating the imagination, particularly celebrating Mandarva and Arijit as, I suppose, vehicles for the imagination, waking up imagination in all of us as we're trying to figure out what it means to be a Buddhist, what it means to be a human in the modern world. So thanks to all three of you for coming. It's so generous to give your time in this way. Both your work, Arijit and Mandarva, is kind of woven through the New Buddhist Center online in different places. We're going to put lots of links in the show notes. So if you're listening and you're interested in immersing yourself in these kind of works of imagination, I really encourage you to go and spend some time. We'll make sure there's lots of ways for you to get immersed. You can do whole retreats with Mandarva and Nagasiri, just leading you through stories and drawing out why they matter. And as I said earlier at the top of the podcast, you could go and learn more about what Buddhism actually is, what meditation is, what our community is, just through the work that Arijit's done to help animate it, literally to find the life in it, as Prasanna was saying. So thanks to all three of you.
Yeah, really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Chandradasa, for you do it so well. Yeah, I really enjoyed the conversation with everyone.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you also. It's been very enriching and helped me to connect with the mainstream of my imaginal life. So thank you.
Get drawing, Prasanna, get drawing those elephants.
Yeah, we want an elephant. We want an elephant for the cover. All three of you have to draw an elephant for the cover. That's the deal.
You're not setting up a trap again, are you?
I think we are. Yes, it's a heffalump trap, actually, if anybody gets that reference. Ernest Shepherd, the great heffalump trap.
Maybe if we all drew an elephant with our left hand. There you go.
Yes.
Are you
James Hillman's
No,
soul meeting.
I'm not left-handed. I'm not left-handed. It just means we'll all be doing it slightly without thinking it's got to be a perfect elephant.
Draw it with your left foot.
Ooh.
Left foot.
I think
Oh,
I might stand a chance then.
Well, it's not competitive elephant drawing, everybody, but I think that's a great idea to do it with your left hand. That'd be really fun. So, hey, we'll be back soon with more Buddhist stories from lives of people practicing, trying to bring it to life as part of our culture. If you enjoyed this story, if you enjoy some of the other episodes, please tell your friends. That's how people hear about podcasts. That's who you trust. You trust your friends. So, yeah, get them to listen. Who knows? Maybe they can end up on the podcast one day too. You can always write to us with ideas for the podcast if you've got ideas. People sometimes do. I say it'd be great if you did one on this. It'd be great if you did one on that. Yeah, we're always happy to hear from you. And we'll see you again soon. Take care for now. Bye-bye.